If they were to return to us after they have passed over, they would say, as did the risen Christ to the disciples who were mourning his loss, Lord, I go before you into Galilee. To those who are united in spirit, death is but a temporary severance. There must be loneliness, and there must be burdens to be shouldered alone that were once shared by the other. But there is not that sense of spiritual annihilation which devastates those who have laid up their treasure where moth and rust corrupt. It is this inner certainty of an enduring bond which is the sheet anchor in times of bereavement, or many, it is a certainty which no materialistic philosophy, no logical demonstration of mortality can affect. They may not understand the grounds upon which their certainty rests. To them it may be a blind belief, admittedly illogical. Nevertheless it is there, a fact of the inner life. The mystic, however, with this knowledge of the inner planes, is able to explain this feeling and show that it is a true psychic intuition, and by no means illogical. On the inner planes there is neither time nor space as we understand it. 28. We are near to those with whom we are in emotional rapport, and far from those with whom we are emotionally out of tune. When there is a real tuning of two souls, they are literally together on the inner planes, where to be in one mind is to be in one place. Do we not know only too well that it is possible to share bed and board, and yet be as apart as the stars? Equally is it a fact of inner experience that if there is a true spiritual union, we remain in touch, wherever our bodies may be. If we observe life, we shall see how true this is. There is a subtle difference between a man or a woman who is well and truly mated and one who is not. They need not to be together for this to be apparent, for it is a subtle psychological difference, and separation does not affect it. The man or woman who loves and is loved retains that sense of spiritual fulfillment even when separated for long periods. It is well known to psychologists that the lack of this mating, which is called by esotericists polarization, is responsible for many nervous illnesses, and that these can occur even in marriage if there is no spiritual affinity and companionship. If we continue to love and be loved, even after the loss of the loved one, this spiritual widowing does not occur, and we are not left unmated. The intangible influence of the love continues to make itself felt, and the personality remains polarized. The bond of physical union weakens with the passing of youth. The bond of emotional union is broken with the withdrawal of the personality from physical sight, but the bond of spiritual union survives all severance, whether of space or time, and continues to inspire and to protect both of those who are held in its tie, upon whatever plane they may be. 29. The bond of spiritual union reveals itself in a common idealism, a comradeship in the things of the spirit. Where this exists, it will endure as long as the spirit endureth, for it is as eternal as God who gave it. This spiritual communion continues uninterruptedly through the death of the body and all the after-death experiences of the soul. It needs no psychic powers to bring it within reach of mundane consciousness. It is like the sound of a brook, we may not hear it when we are busy with the toil of affairs, but in the quiet of the night, when all sounds are stilled, we hear the purl of the running water, going steadily on, hour after hour, and we know that it has been sounding all day, although we have not heard it. When spiritual love is coming to us from the inner planes, we have only to still the outer senses for a moment to hear it purling like the brook, a steady flow, coming to us all the time from the eternal and steadfast soul that has gone on ahead to the next country. And we on our side, if we still love, may send out an equally steady flow to comfort our beloved. Let us therefore gather up all our courage so that the brook of love may not carry the debris of dead hopes onto the inner planes, to be perceived psychically by our loved one to his distress. Let us keep our hopes alive by working for the ideals that were dear to us both. So can we make a channel through which those ideals may still come to fruition, for our comradeship with our beloved can continue in the path of service. Chapter 5, The Appointed Time. We do not wish to have towards death the fatalistic attitude of the Mohammedan, however much we may admire his courage, nor yet the panic-stricken clinging to life of many so-called Christians. Whoever has any knowledge of astrology knows that the time when death is likely to occur can be predicted with considerable accuracy, But if he has had any practical experience of the same art, he also knows that that which is threatened does not necessarily befall. There are a great many factors to be taken into consideration in a horoscope, and the judgment is after all not the answer to a sum in arithmetic, concerning which there can be only one result, but the opinion of the astrologer concerning the ultimate outcome of an indefinite number of counterbalancing factors. Astrology is much more of an art than science, and the personal factor in both quatrent and astrologer is a very large one. No one can deny, however, that there are tides of death in every horoscope, tides on which the soul may readily slip across the harbor bar into the great beyond. The cords are loosened then, and if sudden stress comes, they may part. On the other hand, a compensating force may come into play. The faith or the willpower of the current himself, or of one close to himself, may suffice to hold the soul in the body till the tide has run its course and the knot of life tightens automatically. In such a case we may literally say that a new lease of life has been entered upon, and that there is little likelihood of death until the planets, once again have moved into a fatal position. It is very instructive to retrogress a horoscope, if such a term may be permitted, and observe how the planets stood in the critical periods of crisis in the past. We shall find that there may have been more than one period, that the angel of death drew near but passed by. What has happened once may happen again, and it is as unwise to assume the certainty of death before the breath is out of the body as it is to count chickens before they are hatched. One thing is certain, if life be trembling in the balance, the knowledge an astrologer has is a very powerful depressant and may serve to turn the balance. Here then jump half a page to top page 33, because some of this online text cannot be interpreted. It cannot be other than a misfortune if death comes before the age of 80 years, because in each incarnation a long period of preparation has to be undergone before maturity of the faculties is reached and we begin to reap what we have sown. To have to undergo another period of infancy, childhood, and youth before full return has been obtained from the investment of life values in the present period is a misfortune, though not necessarily a tragedy if seen against the wide landscape of evolving life. We should therefore reinforce by every means in our power the battle against a premature death, but after our allotted span, unless we have work to finish, we are wise to take our guidance when it comes, going tranquilly out with the tide, secure that our life is hid with Christ in God. It is better to go and take a new body than to cling to one that is fast becoming uninhabitable. If we have passed the allotted span, we may well say, Lord, now suffer your servant to depart in peace. By this I do not mean it to be understood that we would refuse ordinary precautions and remedial measures. It is our duty to fulfill the laws of nature as long as we are under the jurisdiction of those laws. It is the attitude of mind to which I refer. We may fight death grimly to the last ditch, holding body and soul together with all the power of a concentrated will, or we may turn our thoughts to the heaven world and begin to reach out towards it. Before 80 years, it is our duty to fight death with spiritual resources as well as material. But after that time, unless there is some definite reason to the contrary, such as obligations unfulfilled, or work unfinished, we do not to place ourselves in God's hands, for he will not recall his servant until his work is done and the time of rest is due. Here to page 34. We must get out of the way of thinking that death is the ultimate tragedy. There are conditions under which it may be a misfortune for all concerned, both for the passing soul and those around him. But on the other hand, it may be the next stage in life. It is only the man sunk in matter who calls the angel of death the great enemy. His esoteric name is the opener of the gates of life. Chapter 6, Traditional Custom and Psychic Fact. There are many old customs connected with the passing of a soul which have their roots in psychic fact and are not merely superstitious. Some, of course, are pre-Christian in origin and their usefulness has passed away, others are still valid, and it is helpful to observe them. Among these is the beautiful custom of placing candles and fresh flowers in the death chamber as soon as the soul has departed. There is a brief interregnum in between die disanimation of the physical body and the withdrawal of the soul from the etheric double. During this period the soul remains close to its physical vehicle, gradually disentangling itself from the meshes of matter and reorientating itself to its new state. The etheric double, cut off from the supply of prana, or etheric vitality, which it derives from the sun while in incarnation, and not yet adjusted to its new condition, is apartment to draw this vitality from whatever source may be available to it. This fact accounts for the sudden feeling of exhaustion and depletion, or even fear, which not infrequently comes to those whose duties cause them to be in the immediate neighborhood of dead bodies unless they have shielded themselves behind the armor of callousness. Those who have loved the dead are especially susceptible to this form of depletion. 36. Now it is undoubtedly a humane act to companion departed souls with thoughts of love and protection, while they are going through the period of adjustment, and we may even, in certain cases, feel it wise to permit a soul that has gone out in fear and distress to cling for a while to our physical vitality before persuading it to take up the task of living its new life. These things have to be wisely and compassionately judged. We should always bear in mind, however, that the help we give to the dead should be directed towards helping them to make the transition to their new life, and not towards maintaining them in an intermediate state, which may lead to their acquiring the habit of death in life, and so becoming earthbound. There is a great difference between a mental rapport and an etheric rapport. The latter is not a desirable thing, it rapidly becomes pathological for both the living and the dead and should never be suffered to establish itself. The will, however, always be an instinctive, involuntary reaching out after etheric vitality by the etheric double pending the commencement of its disintegration, and we can not only protect the living, but help the dead by understanding the nature of this phenomenon and acting accordingly. Fire is an elemental form of etheric life, and the unguarded flame of a candle, fully exposed to the air, emanates a not inconsiderable proportion of etheric substance. If we place a lighted candles round the deathbed and cover it with fresh flowers, there will be available sufficient etheric emanation to meet the needs of the etheric double, tide it over its transition stage, and prevent it from drawing upon the vitality of the living. This is in every way more natural than allowing the dead to get into what may well end by being an unwholesome rapport with those who are left behind, and is at the same time more humane than affording them no help at all. It is not right to leave the dead alone and neglected in the interval between their passing and the funeral of the body. When the final quittance is given, neither is it desirable or necessary to maintain a continual watch beside them, but three times each day, at morning, noon, and night, it is well to kneel in prayer beside the body, or, if this be not possible, to project the thoughts towards the spot where it lies, and imagine ourselves to be kneeling there as we pray. This is a great help to the departed, and should never be neglected, for, next to Christian burial, it is the greatest service we can render the dead. It is not a good thing to burn incense in the death chamber, because the fumes of incense lend themselves too easily to a materialization, and it is our aim to help the departing soul to pass as swiftly and easily as may be through the phases of death and enter into the spiritual life, so that it may not linger within the atmosphere of earth wherein the pathologies of death occur. The drawing of the blinds when a death takes place is another custom which has its roots in psychic fact. Nothing disperses an etheric double so quickly as sunlight, and it is in order that the processes that follow immediately upon the withdrawal of the soul from the body may not be unduly hastened that the blinds are drawn, the sunlight shut out, and the living flames of candles alone used to light the death chamber. 38. An exception should be made to the rule, however, when the nature of the disease has been such that partial death of the tissues has taken place before the death of the body as a whole, or when processes of disintegration follow rapidly upon the passing of the soul, as is the case with certain diseases. For this means that the etheric double has been almost out of the body before the actual end, there is therefore no need to await its disentangling, and the sooner the etheric substance returns to the soul of nature, the better. The wearing of deep mourning has a very marked psychic effect. Black insulates the wearer from etheric vibrations, and a person so clad is more readily able to get in touch with the subtler planes than one clad in colors, which each attracts their corresponding vibration. The custom of tolling the church bell, however, is as pagan as the keening and wailing at an Irish wake. It is intended to drive away evil spirits and should have no place in Christian burial. It is a great mistake, nay, a blasphemy, to think of our loved ones as dead, or to associate them with the dust that is returning to the earth whence it came. We should think of the vital mind, the overliving and aspiring spirit, going up and on with its evolution and calling us to comradeship in that great adventure. It is for this reason that, from the esoteric standpoint, cremation is so much better than burial, for it frees not only the soul of the dead, but the soul of the living. We cannot cling to a handful of dust flying in the wind as we can to a body committed to the ground, returning slowly to Mother Earth. Further from chapter Traditional Custom, page 39. The last earthly service of love should be to take the ashes of the beloved one to some spot sacred to the memory of happiness, and there scatter them on the wind, giving back to nature that which nature gave. There, as at an altar dedicated to love's memory, may we seek to re-establish our contact, not with the dead, but with the ever-living, sending forth our thoughts like birds into the unseen. It is seldom that they will return to us without the green leaf of hope. But we cannot do this as long as we identify in thought our loved one with the dead body. Let us return that body to the elements at the earliest possible moment in order that we may free our love from the sense of death. Where cremation is not possible, then I would plant upon the grave some strong growing tree or shrub that shall draw up the etheric life from the earth and give it to the air. I have seen graves that are little gardens, not sealed with a stone, but full of life and beauty. Between the making of the grave and the placing of the stone there must elapse a period of at least a year, and what can be more beautiful than to sow it upon the bare earth to symbolize the life that is given of God? For there is a legend that wheat does not belong to the evolution of our earth, but was brought from another planet by that great one who came without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. Somewhere in the decoration of gravestone or coffin it is invariable to find the cross. Unfortunately, in our ignorance of the science of symbolism, it is almost invariably the Calvary cross that is represented. There are many different forms of the cross, however, and the Calvary cross represents sacrifice and renunciation. It is the Celtic cross, with its long, tapering upright, and small arms, upon which is superimposed a circle, which is the sign of life triumphant unto salvation. This is the cross beneath which all that mortal of an initiate should take its rest. To enclose a body in a leaden shell is a relic of barbarism. The soul has finished with the lardy and cast it off. Why should we seek to preserve it? The best casket for the mortal remains of those we love is one that will restore them to the earth as rapidly as may be. For this reason the traditional elm is better than oak, which is too enduring if it is not possible to commit the clay to the swift and purifying fire. Let the kindly earth perform its office in its own way, returning the elements of mortality each to its place in nature. The soul is not really free until this has been done. Some shadow of earth will remain to cloud its awakening. Chapter 7, The Death of the Body. The human body is a machine, dependent for integrity of its parts and the supply of its working, like any other machine, upon the fuel. It is a machine for generating energy, the energy which is employed by the personality in the process of spiritual unfoldment, for it is by means of the experiences undergone when in the body, that the soul gathers together the raw material which it works upon in the process of its evolution. The occultist who knows these things is therefore not sentimental over the physical body, but endeavors to keep it in good repair while he has it, because good work cannot be done with a bad tool. We should learn to think of death as part of the processes of growth. A caterpillar dies as a worm to be reborn as a butterfly. In many of the lower forms of existence the cycle of life goes on under our eyes. In the higher forms, however, part of the cycle takes place in the visible sphere of matter, and part of it in the invisible sphere of mind. What we call birth is the process of taking on a physical body, and what we call death is a process of discarding it, and as the processes of birth include more than the labor, so do the processes of death include more than the passing of the breath. If, of course, by death we simply mean the stopping of the human machine, then death is an instantaneous occurrence, such as it is popularly believed to be. 42. But if by death we mean the sum total of the processes which constitute the transition from one phase of existence to another, we are speaking of death as the esotericist understands it, and it is in this sense that we shall consider it in these pages. There are two ways in which death may come, naturally, and in accordance with divine law, or unnaturally, as a breach of divine law. Strange as it may seem, the esotericist docs not reckon death by disease as among the natural deaths. Disease is due to a breach of God's law, in some way violence has been done to nature, and the breakdown of the human machine is the result. Natural death, the death brought about by the workings of divine law, only takes place when the karma allotted for that incarnation has been worked out. Until this is done, the vital tones will keep old age at bay and retain the powers but little abated to an advanced age, as is proved by the many instances of men and women strong in God's service far beyond the allotted span of 70 years. Natural death only takes place owing to the wearing out of the working parts of the machine or, to change the metaphor to a more exact one, to the silting up of the tissues. The machine depends for its working upon the balance of intake and output, technically known as metabolism. The intake is always in excess of the normal output, in order that there may be a reserve available for emergencies. In childhood and adolescence, this extra intake is absorbed in growth, during maturity and reproduction. Top, page 43 in original book. That which is not absorbed in physical reproduction is, or should be, worked off in some emotionally satisfying pursuit, whether of work or play. As soon as the upbuilding phase of life is passed, the surplus of intake or output begins to be stored in the tissues in its most compact chemical forms. Hence the wise and witty saying that a man is as old as his arteries. There are various ways in which natural death may come. As time goes on, the heart finds it more and more difficult to pump the blood through the increasingly inelastic channels of the arteries, the blood supply to the various organs becomes inadequate, and one or another may in consequence get out of order and cease to function, thus depriving the system of some essential product or service, and so stopping the machine. Or one of the smaller arteries, usually in the brain, may become so weakened that it can no longer cope with the increasing pressure of the blood pumped by a still adequate heart, and finally bursts, causing the well-known phenomenon of a stroke. Equally, the heart on its part may no longer be able to overcome the resistance of the arteries, and finally stops its rhythmical drive at the time of lowest vitality, usually the small hours of the night, and the person dies in his sleep. This is the true, normal, harmonious form of death. It is ushered in, not by any definite disease, but by a gradually increasing tendency to fatigue, revealed, and compensated, by the steady rising of the tide of sleep, more and more of the 24 hours being spent in tranquil oblivion, until finally consciousness is withdrawn and never returns. It is thus that the soul passes when it has fulfilled its tasks and has no more to do in the earth life of that incarnation. 44. The unnatural, or pathological death of the body is brought about by some external agency, either the mechanical injury of a vital part, the poisoning of the vital processes, whether by some substance taken into the body, or by the excreta of bacteria that have found lodgement in the tissues, or by the deprivation of an adequate supply of some factor necessary to the fueling of the machine, whether it be food, vitamins, water, air or sunlight. Every ill that flesh is heir to will find a place in one of these three categories, and the esotericist regards them all as forms of pathological death, for, given different conditions, they could ill have been avoided. If the injury had not taken place, the man would have lived. If he had not come into contact with the virulent germ, the trouble would not have started. If he had had adequate supplies of the necessities of life, neither too much, so that the issues were replete, or too little, so that they were enfeebled, he would have been alive today. We can always say of these pathological forms of death that if such and such a thing had not happened, the dead would not have died. Therefore we say that these deaths are all unnatural, and if we were living in the golden age of the earth's perfection, they would not have occurred. The normal way of dying is to die in the sleep in extreme old age. Chapter 8, Going to Meet Death. If we are filled with terror at the thought of death coming for us, let us go to meet him, at our leisure. This may seem a strange idea, but there is a great deal in it that is essentially sensible and practical. There are several religions, notably the Roman Catholic and the Buddhist, which instruct their followers to meditate regularly upon their own deaths. This is a very valuable discipline, and we should all be the better for pursuing it. This meditation upon our own deaths, however, should not concern itself with the dissolution of the body. The body is not the real I. When it is cast off, it is but common clay and we are no longer in any way concerned with it. Let the living care for it for sanitary reasons, not superstitious ones. We should think of ourselves as escaping from the body, getting free from its limitations, and begin to imagine the kind of life we shall lead when this occurs. We can see ourselves meeting with those of our friends who have preceded us through the gates of death. If death appears to be imminent, we may send out telepathic messages to them, asking them to meet us. If we are indeed nearing the threshold, it is not unlikely that some response from them will reach us. We can be quite sure that they will do their best to signal to us across the gulf and tell us to be of good cheer, but unless we have some psychic development, we may fail to perceive their answering signals. I may instance a case I once came across where a woman who had recently lost a dearly loved sister was sitting in the firelight one evening trying to get into touch with her telepathically. She tried for some time without success, when her attempts at concentration was disturbed by her sister's dog, who was lying at her tort, and who appeared to be hunting in his dreams, as dogs do. Suddenly he woke up and looked about him in surprise, as if expecting to see someone, and then rushed from room to room of the house barking joyously. This was the first time he had shown any interest or animation since his mistress's death. My friend was of the opinion that she had succeeded in summoning her sister, but had not been able to perceive her. Dogs, however, are notoriously psychic, and the dead woman's pet had sensed her presence, his experience being interpreted in his dream even as our own are, and he awoke so firmly convinced that he had seen his mistress that he ran through every room barking and looking for her. My friend told me that nothing could have been more convincing to her than this simple little manifestation of a dog's experience. But in addition to those personal friends in whose affection we have confidence, there are others upon the inner planes whose companionship we may seek and whose acquaintance we may make even before we pass over. We may recall our Lord's promise, "I will not leave you comfortless," and pray to him that our guide may be made known to us in life, so that we may pass out in confidence when our call comes. 47. There is, however, no purpose in doing this unless death is near, because guides change their tasks on the inner planes. The work of meeting the dead is one of the first they are employed upon when they come over, and in due course they pass on to other duties. They only come down to the shore to await our coming when the bark of the soul has cast off its mooring ropes. The research that has been done by spiritualists has revealed what very important work goes on in that part of the spirit world which is contiguous to the earth plane. There is abundant evidence from innumerable sources that the bands of invisible helpers are highly organized, and that no soul is allowed to pass out alone and unaided. When a ship is about to sail, she hoists the Blue Peter, and everyone who has business with her hastens aboard. When the soul is about to depart from the body, it too flies a signal, and there are those on the inner planes whose business it is to watch for those signals and see to it that all traveling souls are guided and guarded and welcomed as they move from out our bourne of time and space. Even when the star of death is below the horizon, we do well to familiarize ourselves with the nature of the afterlife states in order that we may become accustomed to the idea of them and that they may not seem strange or terrible to us. We can rob death of its terrors in this way more effectually than in any other.